Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from our year-end issue of the week, dated December 26, 2025, January 2nd, 2026. As usual, the year-end issue is called The Faces of Whatever Year. So this is The Faces of 2025. And the cover drawings are always characteristically busy with all the faces. This one's particularly busy. I will try to do it justice, and then we'll move on into the reading. So the scene here is looks like the demolition site of the east wing of the White House, which has been recently torn down to build the new ballroom. And we've got quite a cast of characters. In front, we see President Donald Trump with a golden sledgehammer and Elon Musk with a chainsaw, both going at a pillar, just demolishing it. To their left, J.D. Vance is dressing down Volodymyr Zelensky, and just giving him the business. Right behind them is a green dumpster. It's on fire. And Robert F. Kennedy is dumping a box of vaccines into it. And we see a CDC sign. Off to their right, Kristi Noem is on a horse. She has just lassoed what looks like it's probably an immigrant construction worker. And Stephen Miller is standing behind him and putting him in handcuffs. Looking on is the new Pope Leo. Looks like he's in distress. Let's see. Behind them, there's an excavator being driven by Pete Hegseth, just tearing things up. There is a golden statue of Donald Trump and Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt is up there finishing off the touches, putting on the gold paint. There's a broken down door to the side, and we see, looks like Stephen Colbert walking away, and then also Marjorie Taylor Greene tossing off a MAGA hat and walking out as well. And finally, in the background, coming out of the White House, is the ghost of Jeffrey Epstein. Quite a sight, and once again, the faces of 2025. As we do each year, and sometimes when we have double editions, we will have two readings out of this magazine. The first week, first show, I will read the more current newsy stuff and some of our regular items, and then in the next show, we'll do more of the year-in-review type thing. So let's get started with the main stories and how they were covered. GOP moderates revolt as ACA subsidies set to expire. What happened? House Speaker Mike Johnson this week blocked a vote on extending enhanced subsidies for Affordable Care Act enrollees, all but ensuring that the tax credits will expire at year's end and premiums will spike for more than 20 million Americans. GOP moderates from swing districts had warned Johnson that a backlash was brewing among their constituents and that he should at least allow a floor vote on the COVID-era subsidies, whose expiration on December 31st will cause ACA premiums to more than double on average, according to the nonpartisan research group KFF. Johnson insisted the centrists agreed to spending cuts to offset the subsidy's $35 billion annual cost. When that demand wasn't accepted, Johnson moved forward with a modest package of health care reforms, including measures that would lower drug costs and expand the ability of small businesses to band together to buy health coverage, which did not include a subsidy extension. This is absolute bullshit, Representative Mike Lawler, Republican from New York, said of the decision by GOP leadership, it's political malpractice. In a sign of rising tensions in the House GOP caucus, Lawler and three Pennsylvania representatives, Brian Fitzpatrick, Rob Bresnahan Jr., and Ryan McKenzie, joined Democrats to pass a discharge petition that will force a vote on a three-year extension of the subsidies. That vote will be held after the holidays, meaning the tax credits will still expire on schedule. And even if the measure passes the House, it will likely be a non-starter in the Senate, where Republicans voted down an extension last week. Still, said Lawler, doing nothing is not an answer. What the columnist said, the discharge petition bill may be doomed, but it will bite Johnson and Republicans, said Michael Gold in the New York Times. It means the House must return to this subject after premiums have surged from an average of $888 this year to $1,904 in 2026, according to a KFF analysis. That will drag out GOP infighting during an election year and hand Democrats more chances to bash Republicans for refusing to address soaring health care costs. The Republican majority is right to stand firm on the credit, said National Review in an editorial. To agree to an extension now would be to accept them in perpetuity, imposing a $350 billion cost over a decade to expand a program that's proven a costly failure. Most Americans get their health insurance through Medicare, Medicaid, or employer-based plans that will be unaffected. To gain an incremental edge in next November's midterms is not worth demoralizing Republican voters who still oppose throwing more taxpayer money at broken government programs. Republicans who endlessly blast Obamacare as a disaster aren't reading the room, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. The program they deem a juicy partisan target has steadily increased in popularity since 2016 and is now viewed favorably by 64% of voters. And Americans have voted for the ACA with their feet. Enrollment has more than doubled since 2018, from 11.4 million to 24.3 million today. Meanwhile, Republicans who routinely fail to offer cogent arguments against Obamacare have for 15 years failed to conjure up a better program, instead trotting out one unworkable proposal after another. As Congress squabbles, the 22 million Americans who qualify for the subsidies are facing tough financial decisions, said Mary Cunningham and Amy Pitchy in CBSNews.com. When New Jersey resident Tina Jump discovered her monthly premium would go from $400 to $1,100 in January, the real estate title officer panicked over how to cover the bill. It's just insane, she said. Those higher premiums will hit Americans already struggling to afford groceries, rent, utilities, and other essentials. Many will opt for cheaper plans with reduced coverage, potentially exposing them to higher medical debt. And the Congressional Budget Office estimates some 4 million could drop their insurance altogether. Republicans are out on a limb here, said Ronald Brownstein in Bloomberg. This comes after their big, beautiful bill cut $900 billion from Medicaid through 2034, which the CBO projects will leave 10 million more Americans without health insurance. The Medicaid and ACA cuts will largely hit low-income workers, the very voters Trump has wooed to the GOP electoral coalition. For decades, Republicans have successfully bet they can win working-class voters with polarizing cultural issues, even if they pursue policies that damage their material interests. But with their assault on health care access, the GOP may be spinning the wheel one time too often. And we have a second shorter main story. Trump lashes out at Reiner after director's murder. What happened? President Trump this week doubled down on his denigrating comments about Rob Reiner, calling the acclaimed director who was murdered at his Los Angeles home with his wife, Michelle Singer Reiner, very bad for our country. The Reiner son, Nick, 32, was arrested and charged with murdering his parents, who had been open about their family's years-long struggle with Nick's drug addiction. Reiner, who directed beloved films such as Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally, and A Few Good Men, also directed a 2015 film, Being Charlie, co-written by Nick, that dramatized his son's challenges. The night before the killings, the Reiners attended a holiday party at Conan O'Brien's house, where witnesses said Nick argued with his father, 78, and alarmed other guests with his behavior. Hours after the couple were found stabbed to death at their home last week, Trump posted online that Reiner, a liberal activist and fierce critic of the president, was a tortured and struggling, but once very talented movie director and comedy star, and suggested his death was the result of his Trump derangement syndrome. Trump added that Reiner was known to have driven people crazy by his raging obsession of President Donald J. Trump. His words drew bipartisan condemnation. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene said the Reiners' deaths were a family tragedy that should be met with empathy. And Representative Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, called Trump's comments inappropriate and disrespectful. But Trump offered no apology, declaring in the Oval Office that he was not a fan of Rob Reiner at all. What the columnist said: Reiner's beloved films are a shared cultural space, said John Dickerson in The Atlantic. Even if people disagreed with the director's liberal politics, they have lived in the worlds he created on screen. His tragic death should have been a time for Americans to unite around common shock, common vulnerability. But in attempting to desecrate Reiner's legacy, Trump eroded the conditions that make shared meaning possible. That's what happens when a hateful, raging lunatic with all the empathy of Jeffrey Dahmer is in the Oval Office, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Setting aside political differences for a half a minute to express some sadness about a bloody murder should be one of the easiest tasks a president can undertake. But Trump, who cares only whether someone offered him praise or criticism, seems incapable of that. It seems some of his supporters are growing tired of the hate, said Karen Tumulty and Sabrina Rodriguez in the Washington Post. That he faced actual blowback from figures on the right who normally stay silent could be a sign that his powers are waning. Maybe, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times, but the damage is done. Trump's policies can be repealed or rewritten, but it's unclear whether the U.S. can ever recover the moral standards he's debased or the manners he's barbarized. America is a train coming off the rails, led by a driver whose own derangement was again laid bare in that contemptible assault on the Reiners. Controversy of the week: Trump versus states. Who gets to regulate AI? Should technology that's going to determine America's future be left in the hands of 50 state legislatures? Asks Michael Salon in New York Post. President Trump doesn't think so. Last week, he signed an executive order setting up an AI litigation task force to challenge state laws on artificial intelligence that the administration considers overly burdensome. The order also threatens to restrict those states' access to federal broadband funding. In an online post, Trump explained correctly that America's global leadership in AI won't last long if every state imposes its own regulations, forcing AI companies to get 50 approvals every time they want to do something. Consider California's innovation-crippling woke regulations, which require all AI models to comply with Sacramento's requirements for safe, ethical, equitable, and sustainable systems, or else face a $1 million fine. But make no mistake, Trump's order is a jerry-rigged solution at best. The Constitution charges Congress, not the president, with regulating industries involved in interstate commerce, and Trump's order could be nixed by legal challenges. Still in this age of congressional dysfunction, and given the stakes of our AI race with China, where there are no restrictions at all impeding development, can we really blame the president for taking action? Trump ran on America first, said Dave Lee in Bloomberg, but on AI, he's Silicon Valley first. Looming over Trump as he signed the order was a beaming David Sachs, the venture capitalist and White House AI czar, who has been lobbying for a moratorium on state laws since last year. Why do Sachs and his fellow billionaires care if AI is regulated by states or Washington? Because they don't want any regulation that might crimp profits, including safeguards to protect minors from suicide-encouraging chatbots, and they're betting on paralysis at the federal level to ensure they don't get any. We need to take the AI threat from China seriously, said former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel in The Atlantic. But state regulation is actually our best defense. The kinds of laws states are passing to tackle deep fake impersonation of public officials, for example, or AI-driven phishing scams, are routinely minimized as social issues by Sachs and company. But to China and other bad actors, weak regulations in these areas create precisely the kind of soft targets that could let them distort elections, fracture alliances, and erode civic trust within America. To preempt these laws in favor of federal oversight that doesn't yet exist would be a disaster. The outrageousness of Trump's order is one of the few things Republicans and Democrats can agree on right now, said Tina Nguyen in The Verge. The left is aghast at the naked profiteering and the possibility that AI could wipe out jobs and further empower billionaires. And on the right, MAGA icon Steve Bannon this week accused Sachs of having completely misled Trump by persuading him to back an AI amnesty, while Florida Governor Ron DeSantis denounced federal government overreach that lets tech companies run wild. Bannon and DeSantis are channeling the real fears of red state voters, said Valerie Hudson in the Desert News. We saw that unregulated social media did to our children and our families. We're not going to surrender and let Trump or anyone once again put the pecuniary interest of tech whiz kids and billionaires above the lives and well-being of the American people. There's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for pivots. After reports that former Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, now in exile in Moscow, is brushing up on his ophthalmology again. A London-trained doctor, Assad has a passion for tending to eyes, said a friend. He obviously doesn't need the money. It's a good week for fat cats after San Francisco-based Ocava Pharmaceuticals announced a pilot study of a GLP-1 weight loss drug for felines. I think this is going to be the next big thing, said Dr. Ernie Ward of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. It's a good week for active seniors after Philip Rivers, 44, emerged after 5 years of retirement to play quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts. A father of 10 and also a grandfather, Rivers led the Colts to a 16-15 fourth quarter lead before the Seattle Seahawks won the game on a last-minute field goal. Despite the loss, Rivers described his comeback as a blast. But it was a bad week for Yuletide Magic after Fox business analyst Dagan McDowell advised Americans to switch to artificial Christmas trees, thus freeing up land for the AI data centers of tomorrow. That's the very nature of a growing economy, said McDowell. Everybody needs to get on board. It's a bad week for childhood fun after school officials in Quebec recommended that children wear helmets while playing on mounds of snow. It doesn't say make sense, said teachers representative Francis Cote, who noted it could take a whole recess to wrestle a class of small kids into helmets. It was a bad week for family farewells after President Trump shared his vision of what will happen when I kick the bucket someday, predicting that his eldest son, Don Jr., will spend 2 days mourning him before heading off to go hunting. He'd rather be in some jungle, said Trump, 79. Remember this, wildlife always wins, unfortunately in this case. And in other news, Hegseth preparing a radical restructuring of military. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is planning a massive overhaul of the U.S. military's command structure, the Washington Post reported this week. In what would constitute the biggest reform to the military's upper ranks in decades, officials are preparing to place U.S. Central Command, which oversees the Middle East and Central Asia, U.S. European Command, and U.S. Africa Command, under a new organization called U.S. International Command. The two headquarters overseeing military operations in the Western Hemisphere would also be merged into a single U.S. Americas Command. The proposal aligns with Hegseth's pledge to cut the number of four-star generals and the administration's goal of moving resources away from Europe and the Middle East. The Pentagon, said the Post, has shared little to no details of its plan with Congress. And we will pick up some of the short pieces from the U.S. at a Glance and the World at a Glance, features we often don't get to. Starting with the U.S. at a Glance, this is from Snohomish, Washington. Deadly floods. At least one person died in Washington state this week as unrelenting storms caused rivers to overflow and levees to break. Up to 100,000 people were under evacuation orders while first responders rescued over 600 people in 10 counties. The record flooding led to mudslides, power outages, and washed out highways. In King County, the White River broke through a line of barriers set in place in 2009 that were meant to be temporary. More rain and flooding was expected, and officials worried about the viability of additional levees nearing the end of their lifespan. A 33-year-old man died after driving into a flooded area around Snohomish, northeast of Seattle. His car was submerged in about 6 feet of water. Other people were pulled off the roof of their cars, said Snohomish Regional Fire and Rescue Battalion Chief Jamal Beckham. And if we had not gotten there, the cars would have been completely covered. 29 Palms, California. Foiled. Federal agents stopped a horrific terror plot by arresting four people in the Mojave Desert, where they were allegedly making pipe bombs to detonate across Southern California on New Year's Eve, Attorney General Pam Bondi said this week. Prosecutors said the suspects were linked to the Turtle Island Liberation Front, which the FBI describes as a violent, homegrown, anti-government and pro-Palestinian group. Another person was accused of a separate plot in New Orleans. The FBI said the California suspects planned to stuff 5 backpacks with explosives, timed to go off at midnight, targeting at least 2 Amazon-type logistics centers. Defense lawyers made no immediate comment. The suspects, Audrey Carroll, Zachary Page, Dante Gaffield, and Tina Lai, allegedly discussed follow-up attacks at Immigration and Customs Enforcement's facilities. That would take some of them out, Carroll said, according to court papers, and scare the rest of them. Inman, South Carolina. Measles spreads. South Carolina's measles outbreak grew to 135 cases this week as health officials raced to raise awareness about vaccine safety. Nearly all those infected were unvaccinated against the disease, and most were children. The outbreak is concentrated in the state's northwestern Spartanburg County, where 250 residents were quarantined. Authorities traced over 30 cases to a church in Inman. The U.S. declared the highly contagious and sometimes deadly disease eradicated in 2000, and the two-dose vaccine is 97% effective. But inoculation rates have dropped as anti-vaccine sentiment has grown. About 93% of South Carolina students had vaccines required by schools in 2025, down from about 96% in 2020. The Centers for Disease Control has recorded more than 1,900 measles cases in 42 states this year, the highest total in more than 30 years. 2 Texas children died of the disease early this year. Greenbelt, Maryland. Released. A federal judge in Maryland last week ordered the Trump administration to release Kilmar Abrego Garcia while the undocumented migrant fights to remain in the U.S., a victory for the Salvadoran national, whose case has become a rallying point for opponents of President Trump's immigration crackdown. A day after that ruling, U.S. District Judge Paula Zinnes also barred immigration officials from rearresting Abrego Garcia, 30, during a mandatory ICE check-in, saying it would cause him irreparable harm. Abrego Garcia illegally crossed into the U.S. as a teenager and has lived in Maryland for years. In March, immigration authorities illegally sent him to El Salvador's notorious Cicat prison. Zinnes said the government wrongfully detained him again on human smuggling charges when he was returned to the U.S. by court order. Homeland Security officials called Abrego Garcia's release naked judicial activism and vowed to appeal. It's not the end of the story, said his lawyer, Simon Sandoval Moschenberg. And some of the World at a Glance stories. This from Paris. Bring back brothels. French far-right leader Jordan Bardella last week endorsed a proposal to make brothels legal, denouncing what he called the hypocrisy of forcing sex workers to operate in secret. Prostitution was legal in France until 2016, although pimping or running a brothel was not. But a law passed that year outlawed paying for sex and imposed fines on clients. While sex workers were still free to sell their services, their trade was driven underground, making it more dangerous for them. Bardella's National Rally Party now plans to introduce legislation that would allow brothels to open as cooperatives run by the sex workers themselves. We can set up secure and closed spaces to prevent this activity from taking place in unsanitary and unsafe conditions, said Bardella, 30. It's a safety issue. This is from Berlin. Progress on Ukraine. After meeting in Berlin this week, Ukrainian, U.S., and European negotiators said they were close to hammering out a joint proposal to end the nearly 4-year Russian war in Ukraine. The deal would see a European-led military force supported by the U.S., which presumably means U.S. intelligence assistance, but no American troops, serving as peacekeepers inside Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine was willing to abandon pursuit of NATO membership because the U.S. said it would give security guarantees that are equivalent to Article 5 of the NATO partners. But sticking points remain, including where to draw the Ukrainian-Russian border in the east, where Russia has conquered large swaths of territory. And, of course, Russia has yet to agree to any part of the proposal. Caracas, U.S. targets oil. President Trump declared the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro a foreign terrorist organization this week and ordered a total and complete blockade to prevent sanctioned oil tankers from docking at or leaving Venezuela. It was a major escalation of his campaign to oust Maduro. Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America, Trump wrote on Truth Social. It will only get bigger, and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before. Until such time as they return to the United States of America, all of the oil, land, and other assets they previously stole from us. Trump appeared to be referring to the U.S. oil facilities seized by Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez. The blockade could cripple Venezuela's economy, which depends on shipping oil to China, despite the sanctions. The U.S. seized a tanker leaving Venezuela last week, which Venezuelan authorities say is proof that Trump wants to topple Maduro so the U.S. can access the country's massive and mostly untapped oil reserves. Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado has made it clear her country would be open to U.S. investment, a $1.7 trillion opportunity, once the Maduro regime leaves power. Speaking from Oslo this week, where she traveled in secret to accept the Nobel Peace Prize, she told CBS's Face the Nation that she fully supported President Trump's actions. "We, the Venezuelan people, are very grateful to him and to his administration," she said, "because I believe he is a champion of freedom in this hemisphere." Palmyra, Syria. U.S. troops killed. A rogue Syrian security officer killed two U.S. soldiers and an American civilian translator last week in an ambush in Palmyra, Syria, the first U.S. casualties in the country since the fall of dictator Bashar al-Assad last year. The two Iowa National Guard members, Sergeant Edgar Brian Torres Tovar, 25, and Sergeant William Nathaniel Howard, 29, were supporting counterterrorism operations against ISIS in Syria, an area that's still not under control of the new Syrian government. The attacker who was killed was identified as a recent recruit to the Syrian security forces who was about to be fired for his suspected links to ISIS. "This was an ISIS attack against the U.S. and Syria," President Trump said. "There will be very serious retaliation." Mashhad, Iran. Police brutalized Nobel laureate. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Narges Mohammadi was beaten so badly by Iranian security forces after her arrest last week that she had to be taken to the emergency room twice, her family said this week. Mohammadi, an outspoken advocate for women's rights, was detained over what Tehran called provocative remarks at a memorial service for a fellow activist, a human rights lawyer. Mohammadi's family said she told them by phone that authorities were accusing her of collaborating with Israel, a charge that has often brought the death penalty since Israel's brief war with Iran in June. Mohammadi, 53, was in prison when she won the 2023 Peace Prize, but was furloughed last December after undergoing surgery. The Nobel Committee in Norway has demanded her release. Hong Kong, Jimmy Lai convicted. Hong Kong media tycoon Jimmy Lai, 78, was convicted of sedition and collusion with foreign forces this week, a demonstration of how thoroughly Beijing has crushed Hong Kong's judicial and political independence. A Hong Kong court found that Lai, a British citizen, had published seditious material in his now shuttered newspaper, Apple Daily, and he could be sentenced to life in prison. He has been behind bars for the past 5 years for his role in the 2019 pro-democracy protest. British Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper condemned the case as politically motivated and called for his release. President Trump said he had personally urged Chinese President Xi Jinping to free Lai, whose health has deteriorated in jail. "He's an older man and he's not well," said Trump, 79. "I feel so badly." Finally, from Beijing, billionaires targeted by U.S. bill. Several Chinese billionaires have responded defiantly to a brewing U.S. crackdown on foreigners using American surrogates to have native-born U.S. children, sometimes dozens of children. The Wall Street Journal reported last week Senator Rick Scott, Republican from Florida, proposed a bill last month to ban the use of surrogacy by foreigners from certain countries, including China, where surrogacy is illegal. Within days, an account linked to Zhu Bo, a gaming billionaire who says he wants 50 high-quality sons to inherit his business empire, posted a video showing a dozen toddlers running toward the camera shouting, "Daddy!" IVF clinics say wealthy foreigners have been paid millions to have multiple American babies. Surrogacy lawyer Amanda Troxler said one hopeful Chinese parent planned 8 to 10 surrogacies and requested a discount. "No," she said, "we're not Costco." The briefing has a Christmas theme this year. Decking the halls. Americans' love of holiday decorations has turned Christmas from a humble affair to a sparkly spectacle. How much do we spend on decorations? Americans splash some $6 billion a year on festive decor. We buy 30 million real Christmas trees and 20 million artificial ones, 150 million sets of Christmas lights, 70 million pots of poinsettia, and millions more ornaments, yard decorations, and window decals. Some extreme decorators pay big to transform their homes into elaborate Christmas villages with brilliant light displays and animatronic characters. Mike Bagwell of Springfield, Missouri, estimates he's spent more than $130,000 on holiday decorations over the years, including on the 270,000 LED lights that adorn his home. "When you see the community's laughter and the joy, it just makes it all worthwhile," he said. All that sparkle adds to utility bills. America's holiday lights collectively use 3.5 billion kilowatt hours of electricity each December, enough to power more than 350,000 homes for a year, at a cost of about $645 million. Then there are the seasonal medical bills, because 18,400 of us end up in the ER with decorating injuries, having, for instance, fallen from a ladder while hanging lights. Still, the emotional dividends of decorating can be profound. "If you haven't had a great year," said psychologist Pauline Wallen, "it can put you back in touch with pleasant memories." What's the history of decorating? Some Yuletide adornments go back to pagan times. Pliny the Elder wrote of Celtic Druids' reverence for mistletoe. But modern holiday decor really took shape in the 19th century. Joel Roberts Poinsett, the first U.S. ambassador to Mexico, came home in 1828 with a shrub that bloomed red in the winter. Called Flor de Nochebuena, Flower of Christmas Eve, in Mexico, it's now known across much of the world as poinsettia. In 1856, following a craze sparked in the English-speaking world by Queen Victoria, President Franklin Pierce unveiled the first Christmas tree at the White House. Around the same time, a craftsman in the German town of Lauche began blowing glass tree ornaments in the shape of spheres and fruit and nuts, then silvering them inside and painting the outside. In 1880, retailer F.W. Woolworth reluctantly agreed to buy a box of the ornaments from a German salesman. Woolworth thought the useless decorations wouldn't sell, but customers at his great five-cent store in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, snapped up all 144 in a matter of hours. Woolworth quickly placed a new order. Over the next 60 years, his retail empire would sell 500 million baubles. What about Christmas lights? They were a homegrown invention. After Thomas Edison patented the first practical incandescent light bulb, he strung a few together outside his Menlo Park, New Jersey laboratory for the 1880 Christmas season. 2 years later, Edward Hibbert Johnson, Edison's business partner, wrapped a string of 80 red, white, and blue bulbs around his Christmas tree. Placed on a rotating platform in the parlor of his Manhattan home, the tree mesmerized passersby. "One can hardly imagine anything prettier," said one reporter. Those early illuminations were pricey. It cost the equivalent of $10,000 today to have electricians install tree lights and be on call if a bulb burned out. But in 1903, Edison's General Electric debuted the first mass-market string of Christmas lights, which cost $12, more than $400 today, and was marketed as a safe alternative to the candles traditionally placed in trees. In the 1960s, plastic blow-mold lawn ornaments shaped like reindeer and Santa Claus exploded in popularity. But sales sank in the 2000s as inflatable decorations took over yards. Where did they come from? They were dreamed up by the same firm behind Big Mouth Billy Bass, the animatronic singing fish. Texas-based Jimmy Industries was looking for a follow-up hit when co-owner Dan Flaherty wondered if he could make a consumer version of the inflatable animals often seen outside car dealerships. Early prototypes used hair dryers, which overheated and burned out. But Jimmy eventually devised a fan that could blow for months on end. In 2001, it launched its first inflatable, an 8-foot Santa, and now sells scores of seasonal specials, including a 7-foot shotgun-wielding Santa in a deer stand. 2014, American entrepreneur Lou Lentine introduced another holiday innovation, a laser projector that speckles homes with festive lights. He devised the star shower as a safe, ladder-free way to illuminate a home. But the Federal Aviation Administration has warned that the lasers can pose a serious safety risk to pilots when misaimed. Americans who shop for such gizmos and other holiday decorations this year likely noticed many prices were up from 2024. Why is that? Because of President Trump's tariffs on China, the source of 87% of all Christmas decorations, import duties on Chinese goods skyrocketed to 145% this spring, before dropping to about 40%. Despite that fall, industry leaders warned that Americans would have to pay 18% more for decorations. Small businesses that import holiday decor have so far spent over $400 million on tariff fees, up 1,438% from last year. "We went from working toward a profit to working for tariffs," said Jarek Hendricks, who runs Village Lighting in West Valley City, Utah. Are Americans cutting back? They say they are. In an October poll, Only 39% of respondents said they'd buy new decorations this year, down from 56% in 2024. Still, the National Retail Foundation reports a record 202.9 million Americans shopped for Christmas items during Thanksgiving week, and it expects overall holiday spending to top $1 trillion for the first time this year. Matthew Shea, the trade group's CEO, suspects Americans won't let economic gloom ruin the holiday. Somehow, he said, Santa Claus always comes. The dreaded Christmas creep. Do stores put out Christmas wares earlier every year? For decades, Americans have insisted that's the case. In a November 1962 Peanuts comic strip, Charlie Brown tells Lucy not to bother looking for storefront Christmas decorations because they're not starting to put things up for Easter. But in 2025, holiday creep is no mirage. Economic uncertainty and a shortened season between Thanksgiving and Christmas Day led many retailers to roll out Black Friday-style deals in October and companies to start pushing snow-dusted ads while leaves were still on the trees. The message is, retailers are really worried that this Christmas season is going to be down, said Michael Davis, an economist at Southern Methodist University, and they're trying to get as much money in the cash box as soon as they can. David Murphy, a behavioral scientist at Colorado Christian University, notes that many Americans actually appreciate the holiday's early start. The nation is politically divided, and geopolitical risks abound, he said. It's no wonder people are eager to embrace the Yuletide spirit. Here's a couple of the best columns, and we may pick up some more of them in the second show. ICE's barbaric war on mothers. The things that are being done by our government to our fellow human beings are monstrous, said Mona Shirin. When its mass deportation program began, the Trump administration told the public that it would target the worst of the worst, rapists, savages, monsters. But new reports by human rights advocates say that to fill their quotas, ICE and Border Patrol agents have arrested hundreds of pregnant, nursing, and postpartum women. These women are grabbed from their cars or workplaces by masked agents, hustled into buses or cars, and whisked to overcrowded centers, where they are denied medical care and even water. Some sleep on concrete floors. In one Louisiana facility, at least 14 pregnant women were visible. Detained mothers have seen their milk dry up due to poor nutrition. Others were frantic about the children they'd been forced to leave behind. One mother was arrested as she was on her way to pick up her special needs child from school. Another was separated from her two-month-old baby. These are not criminals or gang members. They are house cleaners, restaurant workers, and stay-at-home moms. As government thugs pull frantic moms from the arms of their hysterical children, do you feel safer? A major mistake on marijuana. Is the Trump administration signaling that MAHA, M-A-H-A, actually stands for Make America High Again? Asked Alicia Finley. It sure looks that way. President Trump has indicated that he will order federal officials to reclassify marijuana, now a Schedule I drug, as a Schedule III drug, which would put it in the same class as Tylenol with codeine, anabolic steroids, and other less harmful drugs with medicinal applications. The reclassification could make it easier to ship cannabis across state lines and obtain the drug with a prescription in every state. But a growing mountain of evidence shows that weed's easy availability in two dozen states has made young people sicker and dumber. The psychoactive compound, THC, binds to brain's receptors and regular users show marked deterioration in executive function, decision-making, coordination, memory, and emotion. Studies show weed actually increases anxiety and depression. Teenage brains are especially vulnerable to the drug's ill effects, which include a much higher incidence of psychosis. Cannabis users under 50 are 6 times as likely to suffer a heart attack as non-users. A generation of stoners is sapping American economic and cultural vitality. Why make this pernicious drug even easier to get? This is a short piece they call Viewpoint on the columns page. From Michael Hirschhorn in the New York Times says, billionaires control the cable channels, social media platforms, newspapers, movie studios, and essentially everything else that we consume. The sheer scale of this wealth, which beggars even the riches of the Gilded Age, has induced a kind of class sociopathy. Why can't they see how badly they're coming off? For the first time, polls find that a majority of Americans believe billionaires are a threat to democracy. A remarkable 71% believe there should be a wealth tax. A realignment may be underway. A revolt against self-dealing elites may be the only cause compelling enough to bring us together. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. We've got an article here. Tourism, an Orwellian new screening policy. Planning to visit the U.S.? Ask Eleanor Limprecht in The Guardian. Don't. In the latest escalation of President Trump's efforts to restrict entry into the country, Customs and Border Protection last week unveiled new invasive requirements it may impose on tourists from 42 visa-exempt nations, including allies such as the U.K., France, Australia, and South Korea. Visitors may soon have to provide 5 years' worth of social media history, as well as every email address used in the past decade and contact information for relatives. The new requirements for visiting tourists may also include biometric data like fingerprints, iris and face scans, and DNA. These changes aren't definite yet, with CBP accepting public comment for 60 days, but the proposal vividly illustrates how Trump's America has become an unwelcoming country of deep divisions and waning trust. Plenty of nations welcome visitors without trawling their political opinions and family history, so if I were a tourist, I'd pick a less totalitarian place to travel. We live in dangerous times, said Andrew Studdiford in National Review, and the government has the right to decide who enters the country. But this is a snoop too far. Allies will view this Orwellian regime as unfriendly, and it could invite retaliation against American travelers. A policy of policing the speech of visitors could be abused by future administrations, whether MAGA or woke, unwilling to allow foreigners with whom it disagreed into the country. Scaring off tourists is bad for American businesses, said Emma Camp in Reason. We're already predicted to lose $12.5 billion in spending by international visitors in 2025. The most concerning feature of this directive is its vagueness. It's unclear what would disqualify someone from entering the country. Praising a terrorist group, condemning Israel's war in Gaza, or perhaps posts that simply criticize Trump. Those distinctions matter, said the Washington Post in an editorial. This administration has demonstrated a tendency to blur speech it does not like with overtorqued claims of national security threats. Because these intrusive searches target foreign visitors, not U.S. citizens, they may not violate constitutional rights, but it certainly breaks with the spirit of our founding principles. Scouring years of visitor social media history would also force us to cede the free speech high ground, putting us alongside nations like Russia and China. That's pure lunacy. And a couple of the shorter notes. In states that allow online gambling, bankruptcy rates rose by 28% and debt collection amounts by 8%, roughly 2 years after legalization, according to one study. Another study found a 75% spike in calls to gambling helplines and a 20% jump in sales of mass market alcohol brands after legalization. The U.S. Mint has unveiled new coins designed to celebrate America's 250th anniversary, including a pilgrim couple starling into the staring into the distance, and profiles of Presidents George Washington, James Madison, and Abraham Lincoln. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent rejected all designs recommended by a bipartisan advisory committee, including images that honored the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, and the civil rights movement. On the poll watch, 64% of teens ages 13 to 17 say they use AI chatbots, including 28% who say they communicate with chatbots daily. And we'll finish out today with a quote from Chris Rock. Mr. Rock says, "If poor people knew how rich people are, there would be riots in the streets." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.